So great to be back with you. On my mind this week, concern for the millions who face threats from Hurricane Irma and those trying to pull their lives back together after the devastating floods from Harvey. Closer to home.
It's about time. We had a great meeting with Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and the whole Republican leadership group. And I'll tell you,
President Trump made a surprise deal with Democratic congressional leaders. He supported their plan to package Harvey relief funds with a short-term plan to keep the government open and to raise the debt ceiling. My dear friend Susan Page, Washington editor of USA Today, joins me to talk about the ramped-up pressures on Congress. Then we sort out the ominous reports from North Korea.
You have two inexperienced, impulsive leaders playing a game of nuclear chicken in the Korean Peninsula, the most heavily militarized area on Earth. What could go wrong?
First, here's Susan Page.
Oh, Susan, my favorite guest in all the world.
And my favorite host in the whole world. So it's such a pleasure to be back with you, Diane.
Thank you. I'm glad. This jam-packed congressional season got even crazier this week. Tell us what happened.
What a surprise. I mean, Donald Trump has been full of surprises of many varieties since he became president. And there was another one this week. He's at a meeting with congressional leaders. He does something that no one among Republicans or Democrats or on his own staff expected him to do. And that was, on the spur of the moment, cut a big legislative deal with the Democrats. This really changes potentially what's going to happen with this legislative session this month. For the rest of the year, maybe farther than that.
I heard him talk about Nancy and Chuck as though they were good old dear friends.
And not talking about Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan in the same breath or with the same friendly tone. You know, I think President Trump has been very annoyed at congressional Republican leaders because they have failed to deliver on the things he wanted them to deliver on, including the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and because they haven't defended him in some of these controversies, like his remarks over Charlottesville. And he got some payback this week by cutting this deal with Democrats that really reduces Republican leverage, doesn't give Republicans in Congress the things they wanted out of a deal, and opens the door to compromises on other things looking down the road.
So what does it mean for the debt ceiling? What does it mean for the budget? What does it mean for DACA?
So for on the money side, for spending, for funding the government, and for raising the debt ceiling, there is just a temporary reprieve. They've done a three-month extension of the debt ceiling, 3 months more on funding the government. But that means in the middle of December, they're going to have to revisit those issues. So those issues have not gone away. They've just been delayed. On DACA, on the program that offers some protection from deportation for young people who were brought here as children, it really increases the odds that Congress will pass legislatively what President Obama did by executive action, and that is a DACA program. Because you can pass it if you get Democrats and some Republicans. If you get the president and congressional Democrats in agreement on a deal, that is going to pass Congress.
So here's what I'm confused about. Maybe others are as well. During the campaign, Trump kept saying, you know, I support these young people who are here. I love these young people. And then this week he says, I'm doing away with DACA. And then he puts it in the hands of Congress. What a confusion for these young people.
Oh, it must be incredibly difficult for them. And they're already in a vulnerable position, of course, since they've been living here without papers, some of them not even aware that they weren't here legally until they tried to get a driver's license, until they got a little older. So I think this has been really crushing for a lot of the Dreamers. We've seen interviews with some of them about how hard this is. You know, we see stories about Dreamers working as rescue workers in Houston and elsewhere, despite all this uncertainty. President Trump has been on both sides of this issue.
Exactly.
During the campaign, he both said it was a terrible thing that Obama did and also said, I love these young people. They should rest easy, which I'm sure most of them are not doing right now. He went along with the conservative Republicans in taking the action of saying they've got until March, and then the program will be rescinded. Very strong statement by his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, to reporters saying it was unconstitutional. He wouldn't defend it in court. But I think President Trump was quite unhappy with the news coverage that followed, that described this as being really heartless and at odds with what he had said and assured to these young people during the campaign. And since then, and he just, I think, spun on a dime. He then said, if they can't pass legislation, we'll revisit it. Here's what happened this week on the legislative deal on money is there's now another path to deal with it, which is passing legislation in Congress, something that Congress has tried to do for about 16 years and failed to do so. But you have a Republican president and Democrats willing to go along. If they can avoid having an impasse over things like funding the wall, you could very well see significant immigration reform happen.
So as for DACA particularly, will Chuck and Nancy be his favorite go-to people in trying to get this deal through now?
Yes, I think so, because Democrats are totally united in supporting of this program. And Republicans are split. Republicans are not united against DACA. There are some real differences among congressional Republicans on where they stand on this, and especially those who are going to stand for re-election next year. You know, polling shows that about three-fourths of Americans support allowing Dreamers to stay legally in this country. There are differences about whether they could be on a path for citizenship or not in some of the details, but there is very low support for the idea that you really make them vulnerable to being deported.
Okay, so now explain to me what happens in December.
So in December, we're going to have a big battle because they'll have to raise the debt ceiling. They'll have to fund the government. People will be maneuvering to get other things done, like DACA. So December is now the month that we thought we were going to have in September, which is when you have all these big battles going on. But Democrats have gained a lot of leverage now. What President Trump gave up in making a deal now is the Harvey relief money as a leverage, because the Harvey relief money was going to go on to the debt ceiling. And that would make it very difficult for Democrats to vote against it. So that would have probably gotten a longer term debt ceiling through. Republicans wanted a debt ceiling that would go until after the next year's election. They're not getting that.
And what about Irma? You're going to have perhaps even more money needed.
You'll certainly have more money because we only get a down payment now on Hurricane Harvey relief. And we see this hurricane steaming toward the United States now, Hurricane Irma. This is going to be an issue that will come back over and over again. It is one, though, that has some bipartisan support. So hurricane relief, relief for the victims of both these hurricanes, I think they're going to get what they need to get. That's the leverage that people are going to be using to get things that are more controversial.
What happens about tax reform?
That's a big question, because some people at the White House have argued, well, this deal clears the deck for tax reform. I think that is probably not true, because tax reform is going to take months. Tax reform, they don't even have a bill yet. It's going to be at least months to pass tax reform. The administration had hoped to push it through by the end of the year. Well, at the end of the year, they're going to be dealing with more pressing problems like the debt ceiling and funding the government. So I think tax reform just became less likely.
But as you talk about tax reform, is the thinking changing, do you believe, about what kind of tax reform there might be? He's been talking about relief for the middle class, and yet what we've seen is lowering the tax on corporations and high-end earners. And yet, where is this going?
And, of course, they're also talking about things like taxing 401k benefits. I mean, that's the thing about a tax bill. Taxes are hard. You know, we think healthcare is hard. Taxes in some way just as hard, maybe harder than healthcare. And we don't have any of the details yet. There's no administration plan. They're still writing one on the Hill. When you write a plan, that's when all the controversy gets started about what you're doing, who ox gets gored. I think tax reform is tough. There are some elements of tax reform that has that have bipartisan support, like cutting the corporate tax rate. There is a feeling that our corporate tax rate is too high, higher than comparable countries elsewhere in the world. But to get a big tax bill through, it's tough. There's a reason that we haven't done that since 1986.
You mentioned health care. Is there going to be any bipartisanship on that?
You know, that is an interesting thing that also happened this week. We had a Senate committee actually have bipartisan hearings on trying to address problems in the Affordable Care Act, with Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray co-chairing those hearings. That's something we haven't seen in years.
So what could that mean?
So that means that it's possible that they will devise taking some steps that do not repeal the Affordable Care Act, but try to help some of the problems that have emerged for people who are covered under it. And that is a remarkable thing. And I've got to think that Americans think that would be a good thing.
Susan, let's talk about Russia and the ads. Apparently, they took out during the election.
This is just a story that continues to make my jaw drop with each of these revelations. So now we know Facebook has acknowledged to Congress that it sold $100,000 worth of ads to basically a Russian troll farm. They put ads up in the United States that talked to some degree about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, but also just try to hit a bunch of hot buttons like gay rights and other issues that divide Americans, trying to just stir the pot. This raises that's not a lot of money, but it raises at least two questions. One, did other ads get sold to other Russian interests? And number two, were there Americans providing guidance to the Russians involved about how to target these Facebook ads? Because that's been one of the suspicions when you look at whether there might have been collusion between Trump supporters and the Russians.
Now, tell me about the connection between Senate hearings, either private or public, and what Robert Mueller is doing.
Such a great question, because we can see some of the things that are happening with the congressional investigations. We can't see what's happening with the special counsel's investigation, and I think that's probably just fine with him. You know, whatever goes on, whatever revelations we read about in the papers in the morning, Robert Mueller's investigation with what is considered a really top-rank group of investigators are pursuing the allegations of Russian involvement in our election and
is
possible
that
collusion.
All they're pursuing?
You know, you and I have been in town a long time, and I think we know that special counsels do not stop. They go where their investigation leads them. We certainly saw that with the Whitewater investigation with the Clintons. I have no doubt that Robert Mueller, as one of the premier investigators, as a highly respected former FBI director, is going to go wherever his investigation takes him. I think it's going to take a long time. I think we're going to be dealing with this, and the White House will be dealing with this for a year or 2 years or more.
You pronounced it Mueller. I pronounced it Mueller. Which is it?
I'm sure you're right.
I don't know about that. But it is fascinating. Have there been any leaks about what's happening in the Mueller investigation?
The leaks that we've gotten some leaks from that investigation, but I think most of them have come from lawyers for the people being investigated and not from the investigators. And that's an important distinction. I think that has been a pretty tight ship. But there's nothing illegal about someone who's been interviewed by the special counsel's office to go out and tell people about it or have his lawyer tell reporters about that. And I think that is where we've gotten some limited information about what's going on there.
How many people does he have on his team?
He has 16 investigators, you know, people, folks who used to work in the FBI with him. And he may have expanded beyond that, but we know of 16 kind of top rank lawyers and investigators who have signed on to his shop.
Susan, have you ever seen Washington this way?
I never have. This is my sixth president. I've never seen the kind of disruption we've seen this year. The chaos at the White House, the lack of kind of a coherent strategy, on anyone's part. The dysfunction of Congress has continued, but now it's been matched by a White House that has surprised everybody, and we saw that again this week. The president's action this week, it's going to get some of this legislation through this month, and Americans will be glad about that. It could have some long-term consequences in terms of his relationship with congressional Republicans, and he may need them down the road.
Tell me what's happening in the White House between the president and his chief of staff.
So General Kelly has in some ways brought big changes in the White House. He's installed a higher sense of order, more processes. He's tried to control the flow of information to the president. We've seen the president maybe bristle at that a little bit. I don't think he likes the impression that he's being handled or managed. And there are to some degree, General Kelly can't control everything. He can't control the president's tweets. He can't control the president striking a deal in the middle of a meeting with congressional leaders, as he did this week. So General Kelly has a tough task. These are not two men who have a long relationship or a close friendship. It's not like some of the times we've seen presidents bring in chiefs of staff that they know very well. He is someone who's been highly respected and in some ways dealt with some of the problems the White House has had. But this is also a president who likes to have people around him that he's comfortable with. And so I don't know how long General Kelly lasts. He may last a really long time, but sometimes White House chiefs of staff don't.
That's what I was going to ask you, whether you see indications he may get rid of General Kelly.
You know, it's possible, although because, of course, everyone on the White House staff serves at the pleasure of the president. And so the president certainly has the power to do that. On the other hand, I assume he wouldn't do that unless he had someone to replace him with. And General Kelly is someone who gives him, the White House, some standing when it comes to dealing with the Pentagon and dealing with Congress. And it's a reassurance to have someone who is respected as General Kelly in that key job.
Yeah. North Korea. Tell me what you see happening with President Trump in his thinking, his evolution about his thinking about North Korea.
We know that President Trump has really wanted to get China to do more to try to rein in North Korea. That makes a lot of sense. China is really propping up the North Korean economy. About 85% of North Korean trade is with China. And so if you wanted to make economic sanctions really effective against North Korea, you can't do it without China acting in ways it hasn't acted so far. But China has not been willing to do enough to curtail what we've seen happen now, which is development of a much deadlier nuclear device and a stronger missile delivery system that could threaten the United States. So we've seen the president talk about military action in a more open way than previous presidents have. Previous presidents have always said, we have military options, we're not taking military options off the table, but they carry such catastrophic consequences, especially for the South Korean people who are just, Seoul is just 35 miles from the North Korea border. So if you had military action, there would be a big cost with our ally there. But there is a sense, I think, that President Trump is more willing to actually move toward military action than his predecessors have been.
Susan Page, always such a pleasure to talk with you.
And always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's Joe Cirincione. He's president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation. He's a frequent commentator on nuclear weapons issues and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Joe, it's good to see you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Of course. We've heard that North Korea has indeed tested this hydrogen bomb. Do we know for sure that it was a hydrogen bomb?
We don't know for sure yet, but we will very soon. We're still doing the analysis of it. Here's what we do know. It was a very, very large explosion. It registered at 6.0 or 6.3 on the Richter scale. That would mean that it was 10 times more powerful than their last test, which was September 2016. That test, we know, came in at around 30,000 tons of TNT, or about twice the size of the Hiroshima bomb. So we're looking at a bomb that's at least 10 times more powerful than that, so several hundred thousand tons of explosive force. That's the size of an H-bomb. That's the size of the bombs we and the Russians have in our arsenal.
So, and this test, if we can call it a test, was beneath a mountain. Is that correct?
That's correct, an underground test.
And people felt the vibrations.
Yes, in South Korea and in Japan. So this was a big explosion caused a big, big tremor. And we have seismic stations stationed around, thanks to the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization. We have seismic sensors and radionuclide sensing stations that can pick up the isotopes that would be emitted from such a test when they hit the atmosphere. And so those sensors registered the test, and that's how we know what happened. That's how we know the size of it. And we're tuned to judge this to make sure that this is we can tell the difference between an earthquake or a mine explosion and a nuclear explosion. Very different seismic signal. So this was definitely a bomb test.
So what does this now mean? This is a new kind of regime. It's a new kind of explosive device for them to have developed in this short period of time. What's the significance of all this?
So now they have a bomb that can wipe out a city with one blow. So several hundred tons of thousand tons of explosive force, maybe a million tons. This is a true H-bomb, a true city buster. And what it means is that if they can put this on the nose cone of a missile, and we think they probably can, they claim they've done it already. If they haven't done it already, they're real close. Do not underestimate the North Koreans. This is a very sophisticated program. This is making very rapid progress. So if they can do that, that means that their missiles don't have to be all that accurate in order to be completely lethal. They could be off by a mile or two, and it would still hit their target. But, you know, we concentrate a little too much on missiles. It also means they could smuggle this into the hold of a ship and bring it into a port, and you don't have to actually get it all the way to the port. You don't have to worry about customs agents inspecting the ship, because this bomb is so powerful you could detonate it a mile offshore, 2 miles offshore, and you'd blow up the customs service. You would destroy the city. Or for that matter, you could put it on an airplane. You could put it on a truck and bring it across the border. When you have bombs that are this small and this powerful, there are many, many ways to deliver them to the target.
Help me to understand exactly how small it is when you talk about smuggling it onto an airplane or a ship.
It's your size. It's about as big as you. It's about as big as you mind me saying this, a petite person. It goes on the nose cone of a missile. I mean, he showed off the pictures of it, the so-called peanut shape. Well, that is the shape of our thermonuclear bombs. That is our design. In fact, it looks very much like the design for what we call the W-80 thermonuclear warhead. It is a small atomic bomb. That's the big bulge in the peanut. And that creates the pressure, the heat, and the radiation that sets off the hydrogen fuel, the hydrogen isotopes of deuterium and tritium that fuse together. I mean, this is the power of this bomb. You are tapping into the elemental force of nature, the power of the sun. This is fusion powers the sun and all stars. The heat and pressure fuse elements together. So hydrogen, the lightest element, is fused together to form helium and so on. And in the process, they release enormous amounts of energy. That's what Kim Jong-un now possesses.
So, Joe, China must be awfully concerned about radioactive fallout. What are they doing and saying that people of China have got to be worried?
Yeah, this is not in the Chinese game plan. They are not interested in North Korea being a nuclear power for several reasons. And one of them being that it provokes responses from South Korea and Japan and the United States, and they don't want those countries building up the military forces on their border. I mean, already there's discussion in South Korea about, well, maybe South Korea should get nuclear weapons. Japan, maybe they should get nuclear weapons. They're all building up military forces. They're all the U.S. just authorized a new shipment, new quantitatively different kind of lethal military weapons to be sent to Japan and South Korea. So they don't want that.
But if China is that worried, what are they, what can they do about it vis-a-vis influencing North Korea not to go further?
They could squeeze North Korea much harder than they currently are. For example, the U.S. would like China to cut off all oil supplies to North Korea. They could do that. The oil goes through the Chinese border into North Korea. And the Chinese, I think, are willing to do more, to squeeze more, but they come up to a very hard stop. And that hard stop is they don't want to squeeze North Korea so much so that it collapses. That they fear as much as a nuclear North Korea, maybe
because
even more, because that would cause chaos on the Korean Peninsula. There would be millions of impoverished, starving North Koreans fleeing into the Chinese provinces, destabilizing the provinces, fleeing into South Korea. It would make the Syrian immigration crisis look tame by comparison. And then what might happen is even worse as far as the Chinese are concerned. You might see then South Korea take over the North. And so have a U.S.-allied, very accomplished military power now right on China's border. So they don't want to do anything to destabilize North Korea. So that's their hard stop on how far they're willing to go.
What do you think the North Korean people themselves know about what Kim Jong-un has done?
Well, they know what the propaganda organs are telling them. I mean, this really is a cult of in the leadership, and they're told every day how great North Korea is, how great Kim Jong-un is, and his father and grandfather. And there's a certain amount of national pride. And you see this from reporters who are talking to people on the street. Remember, it's a dictatorship, yes, and it's dominated, but there's a certain amount of pride in the accomplishments that Kim Jong-un has sort
of... In a hydrogen bomb that could, in fact, bring harm to them?
Well, yes, but remember, this is how the people of Pakistan celebrated in 1998 when Pakistan detonated its first nuclear weapon. There was a sense of national pride. India, you see it. Even America, I mean, you know, it's still in living memories of some people. When we had the atomic bomb, there was a sense of accomplishment, of pride, even though this is a horrible instrument of death. Yes, you get both kinds of responses.
So I gather you referred to this intercontinental missile.
Mm.
How far along do we think he is in enabling that to even reach the shores of the U.S.?
Well, this is a very impressive program, and we all knew it was coming. Everybody expected this development, but I got to tell you, I think it's even for the national intelligence agencies, it's come faster than people thought. So maybe
what does
a year
that
or two.
Mean?
Maybe
how
a
much?
Year or two. That means on July 4th, he tested an intercontinental ballistic missile that could hit parts of Alaska. And then on July 29th, he tested it at the full range, and it was clear that this could hit most cities in the United States, Seattle, Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, not Washington yet. But and there is more to come. I mean, we're expecting a new test any day. This program is popping off tests about every 3 weeks, and there's a number of ICBM designs that he's shown off on parade that he hasn't tested yet. So he wants, what does he want? Where is this going? This is going towards a force that goes from the 10 or 20 nuclear bombs that he probably has now to 100 or more with several dozen long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. Why? In order to directly threaten the United States. Why? So that we won't attack him. So that we will not overthrow him, overthrow his dynasty, attack it. He thinks this is the kind of deterrence he needs. Why does he think that? Because he saw what happened to Saddam Hussein. He saw what happened to Muammar Gaddafi. He sees what happens to the with Iran even after we strike a deal with them. And he's drawn one lesson from that. If you give up your weapons, America will kill you.
Joe, one thing that surprises everyone, as you said, is how quickly this has all ramped up. What happened to our intelligence? Did we not know this was going to move as quickly?
We knew our intelligence was very good. It's not like we were stunned by this. It's really just a question of timing, of months, of years. And what's changed is the speed of the testing program and the willingness of the regime to move this quickly. So we knew that this stuff was in development. I mean, they've been doing this for decades. This has been something that's been going on for a long time. They benefited, for example, from Russian scientists who left after the collapse of the Soviet Union and brought their rocket science with them. They benefited from Chinese designs that they've accumulated over the years. But it's the speed. And why the speed now? It's an interesting question. Why is he moving so fast? And the best theory I've seen is that he wants to get all this in place before something stops him, before the Chinese stop him, before the sanctions really bite, before the United States conducts a military strike against him, you know, and so that he can then carry out what's part two of his promised plan, which is defense and economic growth. So it appears that he's racing to do this, to put the pieces in place, so then he can feel that he's now fully defended, he can't be attacked, and now he can go attempt, at least, to try to stimulate the economy to the prosperity he's promised his people.
What you're saying is that he does not want a nuclear war.
There's no indication that he's planning to use these weapons. And it appears that he wants them for the same reason that every other power has sought nuclear weapons.
For protection.
Security and prestige. And domestic politics. This works real well for him with the generals, with the American, with the Korean population. I mean, he's delivering on his promises.
There's now also this possibility that the weapon they have now could create an electromagnetic pulse attack. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that.
They mentioned this specifically in the announcement. The North Koreans, they say they could do this electromagnetic pulse. There's two parts about this. One, this is a real phenomenon. We found it out in tests. We used to test nuclear weapons in outer space and underwater and in the atmosphere. And in one of those tests, we blew out the lights in Honolulu. From the pulse of this, it's just an enormous amount of electromagnetic energy that comes out, and it can fry electric grids. And under certain scenarios, a nuclear war would start this way. We or the Russians would launch one big massive bomb over the country and flash it and try to blind the enemy's sensors. Number two is that this has become a real right-wing cause. There's a half a dozen groups like the Heritage Foundation who think this is the main threat, an EMP blast, that this is what an enemy would do with a nuclear bomb. I actually find this a little loony. I don't know why you'd waste a perfectly good nuclear bomb in a pulse to fry people's radios when you could destroy a city with it. I don't get the logic there. But I think Kim Jong-un or his propagandists are very cleverly playing into that fear, sort of poking the conservatives by mentioning it explicitly in their press release on their test.
So at this point, who in this government has, if it should be decided that the only way forward is to attack North Korea to stop the construction of mm-hmm. these nuclear warheads, who has the right, who has the thumb on the button?
Oh, only the President of the United States. Only the President could order such an attack.
But wait a minute. What about the generals around him, advising him, talking to him, in some cases perhaps even pleading with him?
Yeah. Well, let's take two basic scenarios. Suppose you're thinking about this over a period of weeks and you're debating it in the cabinet. Then you'd have all that advice. You'd have all that consultation. There'd be papers prepared, options from the Department of Defense. They're great at preparing options. And there would be all that discussion. And it could be a premeditated choice. Okay, in such and such a hour, on such and such a day, we're going to strike and we're going to do it. But it doesn't have to be that way. It could be a response to something that happens. The president has warned, and now Secretary Mattis has warned, that if there's a threat against the U.S. homeland or our allies or our possessions, including Guam, there will be a devastating response. Well, what if there is such a threat again? What if they launch some test missiles and one of them comes very close to Guam and the president decides to respond then and there? Say he's on a golf course in New Jersey and he is so angry, he is so mad, he wants to respond then and there. The frightening reality is that he can. That 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there's a military officer that follows the President of the United States around with the nuclear football. When the president is playing golf, he's on a golf cart right behind him. He's required to be within a minute of the president at all times. The president could decide enough is enough. He could order that officer to come over. The officer would open up the football, open up the briefcase. In there are nuclear strike
without
options.
Any generals around him, without anybody.
Without anybody at all.
To say, Mr. President, wait.
Exactly. The president and the president alone has the authority to launch. In this case, we're talking about a nuclear attack. And he would then they'd be connected to the National Military Command Center. He'd be put in touch with the general there who runs the command center, and then further in touch with the general who runs the nuclear force. But they're there to receive orders. That is, there's no consultation built in. Once the president gives the order, these people are honor and bound and legally bound to implement it. And in a moment of crisis, of North Korean crisis, if the president was ordering, say, two or three missiles to attack North Korea, that would appear to be a legal order. In other words, a legitimate order. It'd be very difficult for a military officer to refuse under those circumstances. So a great deal depends on what you think about the judgment and the mental stability of the President of the United States.
But here is the other problem, going back to what we said earlier. Apparently his weapons are located in various sites under tons of rocks and mountains. Mm-hmm. How would we know where to attack without killing hundreds of thousands of people?
Oh, we wouldn't. We would kill hundreds of thousands of people. There's no question about it. A nuclear attack on North Korea would be a catastrophe for the people of North Korea. And you wouldn't have any confidence that you would get all the nuclear weapons. Kim Jong-un is a man who doesn't sleep in the same bed twice in a row. He moves around. He knows we're watching. And he's taking care of his nuclear weapons in a similar manner. We don't know where they all are. And now, and what he's been testing, is these long-range missiles on mobile launchers. So we used to watch him erect these things over a period of days, fuel them very slowly. We used to be able to see that. These mobile launchers, they go to a site in the forest, they erect and fuel their missiles, and they're launched in a matter of hours. Much more difficult. So you wouldn't know. And remember, that's just the missiles that could hit us. That's just the nuclear missiles. The real threat from North Korea comes from their conventional force. They have 10,000 artillery tubes and short-range rockets dug into the mountains over Seoul. They're ready to go at a moment's notice. Estimates are that hundreds of thousands of South Koreans would die in the first few hours of combat. If there is a war in North Korea, if we attack North Korea and start a war, you're talking about a conflict unlike anything we've seen since World War II. We're talking about massive civilian casualties, millions of people dying, the destruction of the 11th largest economy in the world, and that's just at a conventional level. If nukes are involved, well, then you're talking about millions of people dying, plus, of course, radiation plumes that spread throughout Asia and across the oceans.
All right. So he's already fired one in or across Japan.
Yeah.
So how close does he have to get before the U.S. reacts?
Well, it depends. We'll get to the reaction in just a minute. But they have steadily built up the building blocks for a reliable long-range ballistic missile that can hit the United States with a thermonuclear warhead. So they've got the atomic bombs. Now they've tested a hydrogen bomb. We think they can miniaturize them. We don't know. There's a little uncertainty about that, but it's well within their capability to put them on the missile. They have a thousand or so short-range missiles that can hit South Korea and Japan right now. They have intermediate-range missiles. That's the one that flew over Japan that could hit. And now they've tested twice intercontinental, that is, a missile that can span the ocean. I would expect more of those. It's not yet reliable. I mean, for a test program, you need a good, well, if you were a normal country, a good dozen or so tests to make sure that this missile worked the way you wanted it to. It had the guidance. It was going to get where you wanted it to go. And then you could not only put it up, but you could bring it down. So you got to test the reentry vehicle, the heat and the vibrations of reentry so that everything works. So you have more tests to come. How many more? It depends. But I would expect to see at least a half dozen more missile tests before Kim Jong-un feels he has a reliable, operational nuclear ICBM force.
And now let's talk about what you believe the U.S. can do now and going forward.
There really are only three basic options, and we've discussed one of them. You militarily conquer the country, and the risks there are so enormous. I don't know any... I doubt very much that any serving military officer would recommend that option to the President of the United States. And you've seen the way Secretary Mattis talks about it with great caution. No one wants to do that. There are military options, but there's no military solution to this problem. The second possibility is that Kim Jong-un voluntarily gives up his weapons. So he decides he wants to win the Nobel Peace Prize, or he feels so much pressure, say the sanction option or the let's get China to do it option, that somehow something intervenes, a China ex machina, you know, saves us from this. I think that is highly unlikely. But that seems to be a lot of what President Trump's policy is based on, somehow getting China to do this for us. But if you say that's unlikely, those two, then you've really left with only one choice, and that's negotiate a compromise. And that's what's worked in the past with North Korea. We've negotiated a pause, a rollback, and a freeze in their nuclear program for 8 years on their plutonium production program, on their missile program. We just negotiated a very successful deal with Iran that rolled back, that ripped out nuclear capabilities, ripped it out, froze it, put it under intense inspections. We've done this with other countries. South Africa gave up its nuclear weapons. We did it with Libya. That's what, unfortunately, we then overthrew Muammar Gaddafi. But you can't, so you're not going to be able to get a deal where he gives up the weapons, but you could get a deal where he freezes his program, where he stops it in place. We could have gotten this deal 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but we weren't willing to do the negotiations. The longer we wait to get this deal, the higher the price is going to be. But even right now, if you freeze it with, say, enough material for 20 warheads, say a few operational long-range missiles, one or two hydrogen bombs. You don't like that. Nobody likes that, but that is a lot better than 100 weapons, a couple of dozen ICBMs, and then at least you've opened up the prospect of another agreement that might be able to roll this back. So that's why I favor the negotiated solution.
And do you believe that that's what lies ahead?
I think that's the only way out of this mess, and I think it's negotiations or a catastrophe, because if you don't do that, then this nuclear train just keeps driving. And you are going to have a showdown at some point. I mean, right now, you have two inexperienced, impulsive leaders in control of massive military force playing a game of nuclear chicken in the Korean Peninsula, the most heavily militarized area on Earth. What could go wrong?
Joe Cirincione, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Diane.
That's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email to drpodcast@wamu.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. The number 202-854-8851, or go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.